Part 3. Breathing Plus. Chapter 8. More on Occasion. The morning after our celebratory Last Supper, Olsen and I hop back in my car and drive down to Stanford for our final inspection with Dr. Nyack. We are re-scanned, re-prodded, re-poked, and re-peppered with questions. The same tests we ran through 10 days ago and 10 days before that. The data for both stages of the experiment, we're told, will be available later this month. We are free to breathe and free to go. For Olsen, that means heading back to Sweden. For me, it means further exploration into the outer limits of breath. The techniques I'll pursue from this point forward will not hold to the slow and steady style. They are not accessible to everyone, everywhere. You can't practice them while listening to this book. Several take a long time to master, required concerted effort, and can be uncomfortable. Pulmonary medicine has many scary names for what these techniques can do to the body. Respiratory acidosis, alkalosis, hypocapnia, sympathetic nervous system overload, extreme apnea, and more. Under normal circumstances, these conditions are considered damaging and would require medical care. But something else happens when we practice these methods willingly, when we consciously push our bodies into these states for a few minutes or a few hours a day. In some cases, they can radically transform lives. Collectively, I'm calling these potent practices Breathing Plus because they build on the foundation of methods I described earlier in this book, and because many require extra focus and offer extra rewards. Some involve breathing really fast for a really long time. Others require breathing very slowly for even longer. A few entail not breathing at all for minutes. The techniques, too, date back thousands of years. They vanished. They were rediscovered again at a different time in a different culture, renamed and redeployed. At best, Breathing Plus can offer a deeper view into the secrets of our most basic biological function. At worst, breathing this way can provoke sweats, nausea, and exhaustion. This, I would learn, is all part of the process. It's the respiratory gauntlet required to get to the other side. As unlikely as it sounds, the first Breathing Plus method I'll explore emerged in the Western world on the Civil War battlefields. It was 1862, and Jacob DaCosta had just arrived at Turner's Lane Hospital in Philadelphia. The Union Army had suffered a humiliating defeat at Fredericksburg, Virginia, where 1,200 men had been killed and more than 9,000 wounded. Soldiers were laid out in hallways, bruised and bleeding on rows of cots. They were missing ears, fingers, arms, and legs. Even those who hadn't seen military action were falling apart. They came into the hospital in droves, complaining of anxiety and paranoia, diarrhea and dizziness. When the men tried to breathe, they'd huff and they'd huff, but they would never quite feel like they could catch a breath. They showed no signs of physical damage. Nothing had happened to them, and yet each was incapacitated, hobbling beneath the whitewashed walls of the hospital, past the rows of screaming and suffering amputees, just trying to find their way into DaCosta's care. DaCosta was a glum-looking man with a bald head, lamb-chopped sideburns, and tired Portuguese eyes. He'd been born on the island of St. Thomas and spent years studying medicine in Europe. He'd become a renowned expert in the maladies of the heart and had treated scores of men with all kinds of ailments, but he'd never seen anything like the soldiers at Turner's Lane. He started the examinations by lifting the men's shirts and placing a stethoscope to their chests. The soldiers' heartbeats were manic, thumping up to 200 beats per minute, even though they were sitting entirely still. Some breathed 30 or more times a minute, double the pace that's normal. One typical patient was William C., a 21-year-old farmer who, after deployment, developed vicious diarrhea and a bluish tint to his hands. He complained of constant breathlessness. Henry H. had the identical symptoms. He, too, had enlisted in good health, then, without explanation, was immobilized. "The man did not look sick," wrote DaCosta, "but his heart rate was, quote, of irregular rhythm, some beats following each other in rapid succession." Hundreds of men would come to see DaCosta over the next few years with the same cluster of complaints, the same backstory. DaCosta would call this malady irritable heart syndrome. The ailments were puzzling in another way. The symptoms came on, and then they would disappear. A few days or weeks or months of rest and relaxation, and heartbeats would soften, digestive problems would abate. The men became normal again, and they'd breathe normally again, too. DaCosta recorded reams of data, and he released a formal clinical study in 1871, which would become a landmark in the history of cardiovascular disease. But irritable heart syndrome wasn't confined just to the Civil War. The same symptoms would show up a half century later in 20% of the soldiers who fought in World War I. The same symptoms again would pop up with soldiers in World War II, over a million of them. Hundreds of thousands of more would be afflicted in the Vietnam, Iraq, and Afghanistan wars. Doctors dreamed up new names for these problems, believing they had discovered a new kind of illness. They told soldiers they suffered from shell shock, or post-Vietnam syndrome, or post-traumatic stress disorder. They considered the ailments to be psychological, just some disturbance in the brain brought on by fighting. DaCosta had his own theories. Back at Turner's Hospital, he suspected he was dealing with, in his words, a disorder of the sympathetic nervous system. "It is the same disorder I'm feeling right now." It's late morning, and I'm splayed out on a yoga mat on the parched lawn of a roadside public park in the foothills of the Sierra Nevada mountains. There's a picnic table full of emergency medical techs eating lunch to my right, an old man brown bagging a tall boy of beer on a bench to my left. Above me, the autumn sun is so clear and bright it's blinding, even through squinted eyes. I take a huge heaving breath into the pit of my abdomen and then let it out. I've been doing this for the past few minutes. Beads of sweat are erupting on my forehead and face. I've got about a half an hour to go. 20 more, yells the man standing over me. I can barely hear him through the thunder of big rigs on the highway behind us. His name is Chuck McGee III. He's a big dude with a sandy bowl cut, rainbow lens glasses, and cargo shorts that dangle just a few inches above his dirt-baked sneakers. I've hired him for a day to help me redline my sympathetic nervous system with overbreathing. So far, it's working. My heart is beating violently. It feels like there's a rodent loose in my chest. I feel anxious and paranoid, sweaty and claustrophobic. This must be the sympathetic overload. This must be irritable heart syndrome coming on. Breathing, as it happens, is more than just a biochemical or physical act. It's more than just moving the diaphragm downward and sucking in air to feed hungry cells and remove waste. Those tens of billions of molecules we bring into our bodies with each inhale also serve a more subtle but equally important role. They influence nearly every internal organ, telling them when to turn on and turn off. They affect heart rate, digestion, moods, and attitudes, when we feel aroused and when we feel nauseous. Breathing is a power switch to a vast network called the autonomic nervous system. There are two sections to this system, and they serve opposite functions. Each is essential to our well-being. The first, called the parasympathetic nervous system, stimulates relaxation and restoration. The mellow buzz you get during a long massage, or the sleepiness you might feel after a big meal, happens because the parasympathetic nervous system sends signals to your stomach to digest and for the brain to pump feel-good hormones into the bloodstream. Parasympathetic stimulation opens the floodgates in our eyes and makes tears flow at weddings. It prompts salivation before meals, loosens the bowels to eliminate waste, and stimulates the genitals before sex. For these reasons, it's sometimes called the feed and breed system. The lungs are covered with nerves that extend to both sides of the nervous system, and many of the nerves connecting to the parasympathetic are located in the lower lobes, which is one reason long and slow breaths are so relaxing. As molecules of breath descend deeper, they switch on more of these parasympathetic nerves. As air ascends from the lungs during exhalation, the molecules trigger an even more powerful relaxation response. The deeper and more softly we breathe in, the longer we exhale, the more slowly the heart beats, and the more chill we become. The second half of the autonomic nervous system, the sympathetic, has an opposite role. It alerts our organs to get ready for action. A profusion of nerves in this system are spread out at the top of the lungs. When we take short, hasty breaths, the molecules of air switch us into turbo mode. These are like 911 calls. The more messages we get, the bigger the emergency in our bodies. The negative energy you might feel when someone cuts you off in traffic or wrongs you at work is what it feels like when the sympathetic nervous system is ramping up. In these states, blood flow from less vital organs like the stomach and bladder is redirected to the muscles and brain. Heart rate increases, adrenaline kicks in, vessels constrict, pupils dilate, and the mind sharpens. Sympathetic states help ease pain and keep blood from draining out if we get injured. They make us meaner and leaner so we can fight harder or run faster when confronted with danger. But our bodies are built to stay in this state of heightened alert only for short bursts, and only on occasion. Although the system takes only a second to activate, turning it off and returning to a relaxed state can take an hour or more. It's what makes food difficult to digest after an accident, why men have trouble getting erections, and women often can't experience orgasms when they're angry. For all of these reasons, it seems odd and counterintuitive to willingly put yourself in a sympathetic state, and then to do this every day. Why make yourself lightheaded, anxious, and flaccid? And yet, for centuries, the ancients practiced breathing techniques that did just this. The stress-inducing breathing method that brought me to the roadside park is called inner fire meditation, and it's been practiced by Tibetan Buddhists for 1,000 years. Its history begins around the 10th century AD when a 28-year-old Indian man named Naropa got bored with domestic life. He divorced his wife, packed a bag, and walked north until he was surrounded by stone towers, temples, and blue lotus trees. This dazzling place was Buddhist University Nalanda, and thousands of scholars from throughout the East gathered there to study astronomy, astrology, and holistic medicine. A few sought enlightenment. Naropa excelled in his courses, mastering the lessons of sutra and tantra. He set out to the Himalayas to put everything he learned into practice, living inside a cave on the banks of a river in what is now Kathmandu. The cave was very cold. Naropa harnessed the power of his own breath to keep himself from freezing to death. The practice became known as tumo, the Tibetan word for inner fire. Tumo was dangerous. If used incorrectly, it could elicit intense surges of energy, which could cause serious mental and physical harm. For that reason, it was reserved only for advanced monks and stayed in the Himalayas, locked up in monasteries for the next 1,000 years. Fast forward to the early 1900s, when a French anarchist and opera singer was making her way up to Tibet with soot on her face, yak fur woven into her hair, and a red belt around her head. Her name was Alexandra David Neal, and she was in her mid-40s traveling alone through India. This was unheard of at the time for a Western woman. David Neal had spent most of her life exploring different philosophies and religions. As a teenager, she'd hung out with mystics. She starved herself, beat herself, practiced Freemasonry, feminism, and free love. But it was Buddhism that really fascinated her. She taught herself Sanskrit, then set out on a pilgrimage through India and Tibet that lasted 14 years. Along the way, she happened into a cave high in the Himalayas, just as Naropa had done. It was there that a Tibetan holy man passed down the instructions for the superheating power of Tummo. David Neal wrote, "Tummo was but a way devised by the Tibetan hermits of enabling themselves to live without endangering their health on the high hills. It has nothing to do with religion, so it can be used for ordinary purposes without lack of reverence." David Neal would rely on this practice over and over again to keep happy, healthy, and heated as she walked for up to 19 hours a day in freezing temperatures without food or water.
"Two more, make 'em good," says McGee.
I can't see him. My eyes are still squinted, but I can hear him, heavy breathing alongside me and cheering me on. I take another giant inhale, then roll the air up into my chest and exhale like a wave. I've been doing this for what feels like 5 minutes. My hands are tingling. My intestines feel like they're slowly uncoiling. I let out an uncontrolled moan.
"Yes," McGee cheers. "Expression is the opposite of depression. Go for it."
I moan a little louder, breathe a little deeper. For a moment, I get self-conscious thinking about the EMTs and that ruddy-faced drunk nearby, who are no doubt watching this spectacle. The city boys hyperventilating on a BPA-free yoga mat, both of us sounding like dedicated perverts. But this self-expression is an important part of Tummo. McGee told me it reminds me that the stress I'm creating is different from the stress of, say, running late for an important meeting. It is a conscious stress. McGee keeps yelling to me,
"This is something you are doing to yourself, not something happening to you."
The stress that DaCosta's soldiers experienced was unconscious. The men had grown up in a rural environment outside the noise and crowds of the city. The more carnage they saw, the more their sympathetic responses kept building with no means of release. Eventually, they were so overloaded that they short-circuited and collapsed. I don't want a short circuit. I want to condition myself so I can remain flexible to the constant pressures of modern life.
"Keep going," says McGee. "Get it all out."
Pro surfers, martial arts fighters, and Navy SEALs all use Tummo-style breathing to get into the zone. It's also especially useful for people who suffer from low-grade stress, aches and pains, and slowing metabolisms. For them, for me, Tummo can be a preventative therapy, a way to get our frayed bodies back on track and then keep them there. To be clear, simpler and less intensive methods of breathing slow, less, and through the nose with a big exhale can also diffuse stress and restore balance. These techniques can be life-changing, and I've seen dozens of people change by them. But they can also take a while, especially for those suffering serious issues. Sometimes the body needs more than just a soft nudge to get realigned. Sometimes it needs a violent shove, which is exactly what Tummo does. That shove is still perplexing to the few scientists paying close attention to such a phenomena. They ask, how exactly can conscious overbreathing hack into our nervous systems? Dr. Stephen Porges, a scientist and professor of psychiatry at the University of North Carolina, has studied the nervous system for the past 30 years. His primary focus is the vagus nerve, a meandering network within this system that connects to all of the major internal organs. The vagus nerve is the power lever. It's what turns organs on and off in response to stress. When perceived stress is very high, the vagus nerve slows heart rate, circulation, and organ functions. This is how our reptilian and mammalian ancestors evolved the ability to play dead so many hundreds of millions of years ago. Reptiles still access this ability, as do many animals, to conserve energy and deflect aggression. Imagine, for instance, the limp body of a mouse in the jaws of a house cat. But people play dead too, because we share the same mechanisms in the most primitive part of our brainstem. We call it feigning. Our tendency to faint is controlled by the vagal system, specifically how sensitive we are to perceived danger. Some people are so anxious and so oversensitive that their vagus nerves will cause them to faint at the smallest things, like seeing a spider or hearing bad news. Most of us, however, aren't that sensitive. It's much more common in the modern world to never experience real life-threatening stress, but to never fully relax either. We'll spend our days half asleep and nights half awake, lolling in a gray zone of half anxiety. When we do, the vagus nerve stays half stimulated. During these times, the organs throughout the body won't be entirely shut down, but will instead be half supported in a state of suspended animation. Blood flow will decrease and communication between the organs and the brain will become choppy, like that of a staticky phone line. Our bodies can persist in this state for a while. They can keep us alive, but they can't keep us healthy. Porges found that patients who suffer from DaCosta-like maladies, all that tingling in the fingers, chronic diarrhea, and sexual dysfunction, they are often treated for each of these symptoms with a focus on each of the individual organs. But there's nothing wrong with their stomachs, hands, or genitals. What they often suffer from are communication problems along the vagal and autonomic network brought on by chronic stress. To some researchers, it's no coincidence that 8 of the top 10 most common cancers affect those organs denied normal blood flow during these states of stress. Turns out that fixing the autonomic nervous system can cure or lessen these symptoms. In the past decade, surgeons have implanted electrical nodes in patients that work as a kind of artificial vagal nerve to restart blood flow and communication between organs. The procedure is called vagus nerve stimulation, and it's highly effective for patients suffering from depression and autoimmune diseases. But there is another less invasive way Porges found to stimulate the vagus nerve. It's by breathing. Breathing is an autonomic function we can consciously control. While we can't decide when to slow or speed up our hearts or digestion, we can choose how and when to breathe. Willing ourselves to breathe slowly will open up communication along this vagal network. It will relax us into a parasympathetic state. Breathing really fast and heavy flips the vagal response the other way, shoving us into a stress state. When we do this consciously, we can access our nervous system and control it. We can turn on heavy stress specifically so that we can turn it off and spend the rest of our days and nights relaxing and restoring, feeding and breathing. "You are not the passenger," McGee keeps yelling at me. "You are the pilot." This was supposed to be biologically impossible. The autonomic nervous system, per its definition, was supposed to be autonomic, as in automatic, as in beyond our control. And for the past 100 years or so, this belief has held. In much of medicine, it still holds today. When Alexandre David Neal finally returned to Paris and wrote about Tummo and other breathing techniques she'd picked up in Tibet and India, few believed the stories. Few could accept that breathing alone could keep our bodies warm in freezing temperatures. Fewer believed it could control immune function and heal diseases. Through the 20th century, interest in Tummo grew, and a flood of anthropologists and seekers traveled to the Himalayas and came back reporting the same things David Neal saw. They told stories of monks high in the mountains, wearing nothing but a single layer of clothes, heating themselves in frigid stone monasteries by day and melting circles in the snow around their bare bodies by night. Eventually, a Harvard Medical School researcher named Herbert Benson thought it might be time to put Tummo to the test. He flew to the Himalayas in 1981, recruited 3 monks, then hooked them up to sensors that measured things like temperature in their fingers and toes. Then he asked them to practice Tummo breathing. After several minutes, the temperature in the monks' extremities went up as much as 17 degrees Fahrenheit and stayed there. The results were published the next year in the esteemed journal Nature. The videos and photographs taken during the experiment showed short men with satchels wrapped around their flabby waists, their skin covered in a thick sheen of sweat, eyes half closed and lost in a thousand-mile stare. The data added credence to what David Neal and Naropa had described, and yet Benson's monks seemed even stranger than an anarchist opera singer or an ancient mystic. It all seemed totally inaccessible to Westerners. That would change by the early 2000s, when a Dutch man named Wim Hof ran a half marathon through the snow above the Arctic Circle, shirtless and in bare feet. Here was a Westerner who had a beard, thinning lead-colored hair, and a face pulled from a Bruegel painting. In short, he looked like every other middle-aged Northern European male. And Hof hadn't grown up in a cave in India. He'd worked as a mail carrier and was the father of four. Years earlier, his wife had committed suicide after years of depression. Hof sought refuge from his pain by deepening his practice of yoga, meditation, and breathing. He unearthed the ancient technique of Tummo, honed it, simplified it, repackaged it for mass consumption, and began promoting its powers in a string of daredevil stunts. Hof submerged himself in a bath filled with ice for an hour and 52 minutes. He suffered no hypothermia or frostbite. Then he ran a full marathon in the Namib Desert in temperatures that reached 104 degrees. He didn't drink a drop of water. Over the span of a decade, Hof broke 26 world records, each more baffling than the last. These stunts earned him international fame, and his smiling, frost-covered face soon appeared on dozens of magazine covers, flashy documentary specials, and in a handful of books. Wim violated the rules laid out in medical textbooks so drastically scientists had to pay attention, said Andrew Huberman, a professor of neurobiology at Stanford University. Scientists paid attention. In 2011, researchers in the Netherlands brought Hof into a lab and started poking and prodding him, trying to figure out how he did what he did. At one point, they injected his arm with a component of E. coli. Exposure to this bacteria usually involves vomiting, headaches, fever, and other flu-like symptoms. Hof took the E. coli into his veins, then breathed a few dozen Tummo breaths, willing his body to fight it off. He showed no sign of fever, no nausea. A few minutes later, he casually rose from his chair and got a cup of coffee. Hof insisted he wasn't special. Neither were David Neal or the Tibetan monks. Almost everyone could do what they all did. As Hof put it, we just had to, quote, breathe, motherfucker! He proved his point 3 years later, when researchers brought in 24 healthy male volunteers and randomly split them into two groups. Half the men spent the next 10 days learning Hof's version of Tummo while exposing themselves to cold. The controls received no training. The two groups were brought back into the lab, and each was hooked up to monitors and injected with E. coli. The group trained by Hof were able to control their heart rate, temperature, and even their immune response. They hardly suffered any symptoms. The controls, meanwhile, were sick and nauseous. This practice of heavy breathing was later discovered to release the stress hormones adrenaline, cortisol, and norepinephrine, all of which work to kill off pathogens, blunt inflammation, and flood the body with self-made opioids and dopamine. All that with just a few hundred quick and heavy breaths. One more, says McGee, then let it all out and hold. I do as instructed and listen as the rushing wind that was pouring from my lungs suddenly stops. I'm left to bathe in pure silence, the kind of jarring quietude a skydiver feels the moment a parachute opens. But this stillness is coming from inside. As I hold my breath longer, I feel the heat spread across my body. I focus on my heart, rock to its vibrations. Each thump sounds and feels like the kick drum from the beginning of Black Sabbath's Iron Man. Make the silence between your heartbeats last an eternity, McGee says in a soothing voice. After a minute or so, He directs me to take in a huge breath without exhaling and then hold it for about 15 seconds. I'll move the breath around my chest, just below my neck. Then, at his order, I exhale everything out and the cycle starts all over again. "Three more rounds," McGee says, his voice raising to a yell. "Be your own superpower." As I'm huffing away, I slide my focus to McGee. He told me earlier that 6 years ago, he'd been diagnosed with type 1 diabetes at the age of 33. His pancreas shut down and no longer produced insulin. Then he suffered from chronic back pain, making him anxious and severely depressed. His blood pressure shot through the roof. McGee's doctor gave him insulin injections to help stabilize the diabetes, enalapril to lower his blood pressure, and Valium to ease the pain. In addition, he was taking 4 to 5 ibuprofen every day. But nothing really helped. He only got sicker. McGee was like 15% of the American population. That's more than 50 million people who suffer from an autoimmune disorder. In simple terms, these diseases are the result of an immune system that goes rogue and starts attacking healthy tissues. Joints become inflamed, muscles and nerve fibers waste away, rashes cover the skin. The ailments go by many names: rheumatoid arthritis, multiple sclerosis, Hashimoto's disease, and even diabetes. Pharmaceutical treatments like immunosuppressants work by easing symptoms and keeping the patient more comfortable, but they do nothing to address the core malfunction in the body. Autoimmune diseases have no known cure, and even the causes are debated. An increasing body of research has shown that many are tied to the dysfunction of, you guessed it, the autonomic nervous system. McGee's awareness of alternative treatments began when a friend mentioned a short feature on someone named the Iceman. That night, McGee tried Wim Hof's heavy breathing technique. "For the first time in a long time, I slept peacefully," he told me. He signed up for Hof's 10-week video course, and soon after, his insulin levels normalized, pain subsided, and blood pressure plunged. He quit taking enalapril and reduced his insulin intake by around 80%. He still took ibuprofen, but only a pill or two once a week. McGee was hooked. He flew to Poland to attend an instructor retreat where he and dozens of other students spent weeks hiking up snowy mountains and swimming in freezing lakes. They breathed a lot. It never felt like a competition to McGee, or like some extreme fitness regime. "Fight it, no pain, no gain, that's all bullshit. That's how you get hurt," McGee explained. The point was to rebalance the body so that it could do what it is naturally adapted to do. There are dozens of stories, men mostly in their 20s, who'd suddenly been diagnosed with psoriasis or depression, who weeks after practicing heavy breathing no longer suffered any symptoms. 20,000 others in Hof's community exchanged blood work data and other metrics on their transformations online. The before and after results confirmed their claims. Some people were reducing inflammatory markers like C-reactive protein by a factor of 40 within just a few weeks. "Doctors say this is more pseudoscience than science, that there's no way any of this can be true," McGee said. And yet McGee and thousands of other heavy breathers kept showing profound improvements. They kept getting off medications they'd been on for years. They kept heating themselves and healing themselves. Back on the park lawn, there's no more huffing, no more irritable heart. The journey into self-inflicted sympathetic stress is over. Outside, the world seems to yawn awake in a Disney-like montage. The crackle of pine needles beneath the feet of a squirrel, the brush of wind along the branches, the caw of a distant hawk, all of it broadcast in high fidelity. Getting here took some effort, and if I wasn't laid out on a mat, breathing this hard for this long could be dangerous. McGee repeatedly told me, as he told all his students, to never, ever practice TUMO while driving, walking, or in any other environment where you might get hurt if you pass out. Nobody knows how eliciting such extreme stress might affect the immune and nervous systems in the long run. Some pulmonauts, like Anders Olsen, argue that this kind of forced overbreathing can actually be more damaging than it's worth. I'm less certain. Alexandra David Neal used TUMO and other ancient breathing practices until she died in 1969 at the age of 100. One of her acolytes, a man named Maurice DeBar, is still alive. DeBar had spent his teenage years bedridden in a village hospital with tuberculosis, lung inflammation, and other illnesses. By his 20s, the doctors had given up. DeBar decided to heal himself. He read books, trained in yoga, and learned TUMO. He not only completely cured his body of any sickness, but gained a superhuman strength. On his off hours of working as a hairdresser, he'd strip down to his underwear and run barefoot through snowy forests. He immersed himself in ice from the neck down and sat there motionless for 55 minutes. Later, he ran 150 miles beneath the searing sun of the Sahara Desert. But his greatest feat, DeBar said, was helping thousands of others with illnesses learn the power of TUMO to heal themselves, just as he'd done. The human is not only an organism, it is also a mind whose strength used wisely can allow us to repair our body when it wobbles, wrote DeBar. As of this recording, DeBar is 90 years old. He still plays harp, reads without glasses, and leads TUMO retreats in the Italian Alps, where students join him in stripping down to their underwear and sitting in the snow for an hour, then hike half-naked up mountains, then finish with a dip in an alpine lake. TUMO is for the reconstitution of man's immune system, DeBar proclaimed. It's a fabulous way for the future of man's health. TUMO isn't the only heavy breathing technique to have recently had a resurgence in the West. Several years ago, when I was early in my research, I'd heard about a practice called holotropic breathwork created by a Czech psychiatrist named Stanislav Grof. The main focus wasn't to reboot the autonomic nervous system or even heal the body. It was to rewire the mind. An estimated 1 million people had tried it, and today more than 1,000 trained facilitators run workshops around the world. I paid a visit to Grof, whose home was just a half an hour north of me in Marin County. He greeted me in a blue Oxford shirt, khakis, and clogs. We walked into his living room, past Buddhist figures and stacks of the 20 books he'd written over the years. Two sliding glass doors offered a view of hills sprinkled with red tile rooftops. We took a seat at a patio table, and Grof told me how it all began. It was November 1956, and Grof was a student at the Czechoslovak Academy of Sciences in Prague. The university's psychology department received a sample of a new drug from Sandoz, a Swiss pharmaceutical company. The drug was originally developed to treat menstrual and headache pain, but Sandoz found that its side effects, which included hallucinations, were too severe to make it marketable. Sandoz thought psychiatrists might use it to better understand and to communicate with their schizophrenic patients. Grof volunteered to try it. An assistant strapped him into a chair and injected him with 100 micrograms. Grof later recalled, "I saw light as I had never seen it before. I could not believe it existed. My first thought was that I was looking at Hiroshima. I then saw myself above the clinic, Prague, the planet. Consciousness had no boundaries. I was beyond the planet. I had cosmic consciousness." Grof was one of the first ever test subjects of lysergic acid diethylamide, better known as LSD. The experience would guide Grof's research for the next half century, and he'd use it on many patients suffering from schizophrenia and addiction. By 1968, the U.S. government had outlawed LSD, so Groff and his wife, Christina, sought a therapy with the same hallucinatory and healing effects that wouldn't get them thrown in jail. They discovered heavy breathing. The Groff's technique was essentially Tummo cranked up to 11. It involved lying on a floor in a dark room with loud music playing, breathing as hard and as quickly as you can for up to 3 hours. They found that willingly breathing to this point of exhaustion could place patients in a state of stress where they could access unconscious thoughts. Essentially, the therapy helped people blow a fuse in their minds so they could return to a state of groovy calm. The Groffs called it holotropic breathwork, from the Greek holos, which means whole, and tripine, which translates to progressing towards something. Holotropic breathwork broke the mind down and moved it towards wholeness. It took some doing. The experiences often included a journey through a, quote, dark night of the soul, where patients would have a, quote, painful confrontation with themselves. Sometimes they might vomit or suffer nervous breakdowns. If they got through all that, mystical visions, spiritual awakenings, and rebirthing experiences often followed. It was so powerful that patients reported seeing their whole lives flash before their eyes. "We took psychotic people, people nobody else wanted to deal with, people for whom any medicines weren't working," said Dr. James Ironman, a psychiatrist who has used the therapy in his practice for the past 30 years. From 1989 to 2001 at St. Anthony's Medical Center in St. Louis, Ironman led more than 11,000 patients through holotropic breathwork. He documented the experiences of 482 of them and found that the therapy had significant and lasting benefits. A 14-year-old patient who tried to slit his throat breathed a few holotropic breaths and sailed off into an altered state of, quote, pure consciousness. A 31-year-old woman addicted to several drugs had an out-of-body experience and afterwards sobered up and went on to lead a 12-step program. Ironman saw thousands of similar transformations and reported no side effects. "These patients would get pretty wild, but it worked for them," he told me. "It worked incredibly well, and the hospital staff just couldn't figure out why." A few smaller studies followed and showed positive outcomes for people with anxiety, low self-esteem, and asthma. I wanted to feel it for myself, so I signed up for a session. On a crisp fall day, I drove a few hours north of Groff's home to a hot springs resort tucked beneath the shade of ancient redwoods. There were dusty yurts, heavily bearded men in toe shoes, women in braids, and homemade granola in mason jars. It was exactly the kind of scene I'd expected. What I didn't expect were the corporate lawyers, architects in polo shirts, and muscle men in flat tops who had also gathered there. A dozen of us walked into an activity room. Half the group lay down on the floor and prepared to breathe, while the other half, the sitters, watched over them. I volunteered to be a sitter for a man named Kerry, who wore Armani glasses and asked me not to touch him during the session because he feared any contact might burn his skin. The music started, a predictable mix of thumping techno and reverberating lutes. What happened next was pretty predictable, too. The business folks breathed heavily and wiggled around on their mats, but mostly kept calm and to themselves. Meanwhile, the natural healers went apeshit. After just a few minutes of breathing, a big man named Ben, who lived off the grid in a cabin, sat up and stared in awe at the palms of his hands as if he were holding a magic hobbit stone. A few more breaths and Ben began snorting and scratching his crotch. He growled and howled like a wolf, then took off around the room on all fours. The therapist running the session snuck up behind Ben and wrestled him down. They sat on him until he transmogrified back into a human. Behind Ben, a woman named Mary jabbed her eyes with her knuckles and screamed in an alternating devil and baby voice, "I want my mommy! I hate you, mommy! I want my mommy! I hate you, mommy!" She wormed to a corner and curled up like an abused dog. This went on for 2 hours. I couldn't help notice that neither Mary nor Ben were breathing any faster or deeper than anyone else. They weren't breathing any faster or deeper than me, and I was just sitting there, calmly watching the scene unravel. By afternoon, the group switched positions, and it was my turn to walk through the dark night of the soul. I'll admit, I was pretty dubious at this point, but I gave it my all, breathing as hard as I could for as long as I could. I felt really hot and sweated. Then I felt really cold and sweated. My legs went numb, my fingers uncontrollably coiled into claws, a common side effect called tetany. My mind wandered. I was convinced at one point I'd entered into some waking dream where the sounds, music, and sensations of my surroundings mingled freely with subconscious thought. Sometime later, the hollow electric drums and the fake cymbal crashes faded back into my consciousness. It was all over. The group was invited to sit around a table and draw mandalas with crayons on what they'd just experienced. I instead walked outside into the perfumed evening air and drank a warm beer alone in the passenger seat of my car. On one hand, holotropic breathwork was transformative for Ben and Mary and the hundreds of thousands of others who'd experienced it. On the other, there was obviously some psychosomatic influence going on here. I couldn't help wondering how much of its curative effects were the result of the environment, of all that set and setting, and how much might be an actual measurable response to breathing so heavily for so long. Groff believed that at least some of the magic was triggered by having less oxygen in the brain. During rest, about 750 milliliters of blood, that's enough to fill a wine bottle, flows through the brain every minute. That changes when we breathe heavily. Whenever the body is forced to take in more air than it needs, we'll exhale too much carbon dioxide, which will narrow the blood vessels and decrease circulation. Within just a few minutes or even a few seconds of overbreathing, brain blood flow can decrease by 40%, an incredible amount. The areas most affected by this are the brain's hippocampus and parieto-occipital cortices, which together govern functions such as visual processing, memory, the experience of time, and sense of self. Disturbances in these areas can elicit powerful hallucinations, which include things like out-of-body experiences and waking dreams. If we keep breathing a little faster and a little deeper, more blood will drain from the brain, and all those hallucinations can become more profound. In addition, the sustained pH imbalance in the blood sends distress signals throughout the body, specifically to the limbic system, which controls emotions and arousal, among other things. Doing this for long enough, say 3 hours at a time, may trick the limbic system into thinking the body is dying. This could explain why so many people experience so many sensations of death and rebirth during these holotropic sessions. They have consciously driven their bodies into a state that it perceives as lethal, and then lulled it back out. Groff admitted that researchers were a long way from really understanding the full picture. He was okay with that. He just knew holotropic breathwork offered a heavy shove that patients needed, but weren't getting with any other therapies. Heavy breathing alone did for them what nothing else could do.